Today is Thursday. It's May 28th, 2020. It's 1:39 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and we're the Mincing Rascals. You can listen to my radio show on WGN weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter, except this week because I'm on furlough.
Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Eric Zorn, the evidently non-essential columnist from the Tribune, because I'm going on furlough next week.
Yeah, and not to dwell on it, but let's just dwell on it, guys. That's not lost on us. That sucks. We're really sorry to hear that. And it's at least nice to see the social media reaction to what you all are going through. That's a lot of love and support for you out there. But right now, you ain't getting paid, huh?
We can file for unemployment. And so there's that. And we, for now, still have a job to go back to. We do have to take 3 weeks and some by the end of July. So, you know, everybody's facing hardships. But yeah, that's it.
I saw someone from the Tribune tweet today, the business section was entirely AP bylines. I think that maybe that was yesterday or this morning. And that was shocking to me.
Yeah, there are certainly people out there with worse problems than 3 weeks of furlough. And if that's all that we have to endure, you know, that will be probably end up being kind of a blessing. But I think we're just starting a really tough, tough year for the Tribune. And Lisa and I are hanging on by our fingernails. So. Yeah. With everybody else.
Will you both get unemployment compensation and then a $600 additional check?
I guess.
I'm waiting to see. I applied and it was somewhat difficult. So we'll see. We'll see. They'd let you know by snail mail, if you've done it correctly and or if you qualify.
Yeah, I saw things were really bad at Channel 2, that they had to lay off a bunch of people there.
And Aaron Kennedy,
Pam Zekman,
Megan Claros. Yeah, I was sorry to see that. I was talking on the radio today to some other radio talk show hosts around the country. One was from California, and he said that, in fact, with that extra $600, some of his colleagues who have been furloughed are thinking they don't want to come back. They're making more money not working than they are at the radio station.
Well, that $600 is going to run out, though. I think that extra money will run out at the end of July. Is that right?
That's right. So let's get started with this happy jolly train.
I derailed the podcast again. I apologize.
Well, let's start with the president. He tweeted that, quote, there is no way that mail-in ballots will be anything less than substantially fraudulent. Mailboxes will be robbed, ballots will be forged, and even illegally printed out and fraudulently signed. The governor of California is sending ballots to millions of people, the president tweeted. Anyone living in the state, no matter who they are or how they got there, will get one. This will be a rigged election. No way. Under those successive tweets, Twitter wrote, get the facts about mail-in ballots. And when you hit that button, it takes you to articles by CNN, The Hill, and Washington Post. Twitter also clarified, they wrote, there is no evidence that mail-in ballots are linked to voter fraud and that California is not mailing ballots to anyone, but only registered voters. And finally, they note that 5 states already vote entirely by mail. I think the first question I have for you is this too little, too late by Twitter?
Well, it seems to me that it's very, very difficult when you have a platform like that to monitor everything that's going out over the platform. And you have a protection under federal law if you're running something like that that says that you're not a publisher, you're just kind of providing a forum. And so you're not responsible. So if somebody says something awful, like accuses somebody of murder, for instance, then that's not your fault, you being Twitter at that point. And so when they start getting into this moderation game or fact-checking game, there's really no end to that. And I don't know exactly what I would recommend that they do, but I know that they may end up having some sort of legal problem if they say, well, you know, you can't come in here and fact check the president if you're not going to fact check Joe Biden or Dick Durbin or anybody else. You know, it's like it's the thin end of a really interesting wedge.
And just do it for everybody. OK, if you're tweeting about this, here's something you might want to read, you know, get the facts or something on everything. I don't know how many millions of Twitter users there are at this point, but I can't imagine.
What about not engaging and just saying, okay, we're not going to bother with the veracity of Trump tweets, we're just not going to allow him on the platform anymore.
I think this showed how much of an own goal it is to try to do something specifically related to the president on Twitter. And they're personally, they're a private company. They can do whatever they want. They can run their platform however they want. But to do that was such a bonehead move. And even if you're doing it just from a purely non-political, like factual standpoint, if some public figure were to tweet something like, there is no fraud associated with mail-in ballots, which is false. Like, yeah, of course, just like there is voter fraud with anything, there is some, but there wouldn't be a big, you know, disclaimer behind, below it saying like, get the real facts on the blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so I'm glad corporations are treated like people and that they have First Amendment rights and that they can do stuff like this without legal penalty. But as Eric said, it sounds like the executive order may take aim at that lack of liability for people posting on the platform, which I think would be very bad. And the reason I think it's bad is for the same reason we do not, if someone called up 100 people and said, I'm going to kill someone, the phone company is not liable for that speech. And I think the same should apply to online platforms. But that's the like leverage that Trump has right now.
Right, it's definitely it's payback, isn't it? This is he wants to clarify these regulations under that Communications Decency Act. I think is what it's called. It's what you're talking about, right? The federal law that exempts online platforms from this legal liability for the substance of material that's posted. It could expose them to more lawsuits, but it's also a way to silence them.
It's impossible. If they were to decide that Facebook is responsible and Twitter is responsible for everything people post, they would really have to close down in a way because they can't. The expense of monitoring that would be completely unworkable. The personnel time commitment that would be involved is crazy. So, you know, when you have a radio station, you have a talk show like John has, you have Elif screening the callers, and then if somebody says something inappropriate, you've got a 5-second dump button that so you can make a radio station responsible for a series of people coming on and commenting. But if you're just going to open up all your phone lines and let people talk all they wanted on your air, it would be impossible to screen them. So that's the situation. You would basically put an end to Facebook and Twitter if you required them to monitor all their content.
What about the whole idea, though, of people planning and saying, okay, this is wrong? I think that's probably where Twitter is coming from, where people were complaining and maybe saw that as a way to sort of shut things down. Should that not be an outlet and then a chance to look at it? I mean, if it's going to be sort of an organic process and if it's founded, you'll get a little accuracy check right beneath your post.
Well, it sounds very nice, but I'm trying to imagine how many hundreds of thousands of employees you'd have to have. Donald Trump has 80 million Twitter followers.
Right.
Presumably many of them are tweeting things in support of him. Who's going to read 80 million Twitter users and what they're posting?
And too, Twitter probably wants to be careful because he's drawing people to the platform. Right? Austin, you nailed it. It's a private company. A lot of people come to Twitter, especially journalists, to see what he's saying, sort of rolling the ball on policy questions and makes announcements through Twitter. So
I'm thinking, so first I'll preface this by saying, I think the discourse on the right about conservative speech being censored is stupid for the most part and not true. I also think on the left, this is such short-term thinking to be complaining to platforms to do stuff like this, because if you give them the power to do, this is kind of like how government works too. If you give them the power to decide what is accurate and not, like on a platform level, that's not going to be used for the interests of like the poor and downtrodden. It's going to be used for the interests of the most powerful people who can leverage these corporations. Like it's not going to end well for disenfranchised people if you give platforms the power to do that. And if you ask for it.
You know, I appreciate the interest in this one particular case about voter fraud or whatever, but Trump lies all the time.
Yeah, this week, Congressman Kinzinger called him, he's, you know, Central Illinois. He called Trump out over this business of tweeting about how Joe Scarborough, who is a morning host on MSNBC, some years ago when he was in Congress, he had a staffer who died accidentally in the congressional office. And Trump tweeted out something that sort of linked Scarborough as maybe being responsible, and she had some kind of a heart issue and collapsed and hit her head and passed away. And her family's absolutely beside themselves about this. And Kinziger told her to stop it, quit doing this to the family. It's not true. It's rumor mongering.
Well, it's also dangerous. That might inspire some sort of vigilante, some sort of nutcase to say, I'll right this wrong. But I mean, so right. I don't know why Twitter has suddenly decided that this is the straw that broke the camel's back. His sins are so many and egregious. This, to me, pales by comparison. So I'm trying to figure out why they are suddenly interested in this topic.
Well, are they suddenly interested, or are people deciding, hey, this is the hill to die on? Let's swap
this one?
Twitter.
Really? Do you think
yes,
so?
Yes, because it's about the election. Yes, and they can go and say he's not telling the truth on this issue.
Lisa, if I did brackets. Mm-hmm. Give me 64 teams. This would be a 12 seed. This would be a 14 seed for me.
I'm not saying I think it is. I'm telling you that I think that enough people complained about this because they feel so strongly about the election and that, okay, people are going to stay away in droves because of the virus, that they may feel like, oh my God, you know, if he's out here, they're telling people this, they're just not going to vote. They're going to shut down any kind of mail-in system. And people are just going to skip voting.
Does Twitter benefit from having him on the platform? I guess the answer is obvious, right? That would be yes.
I was getting at not very artfully before. I think that they have to sort of walk a tightrope because there are people who come to Twitter to hear him, to see what he has to say.
So they love it. So
yeah,
they love it. Even though
he'll roll out policy, he'll go after his enemies.
Well, then we should shut him down for that.
You know, I would agree with Austin's assessment that this was an own goal by Twitter, that it was not a smart – this was not a hill to die on. This was not a fight to pick. If you want to pick a fight with him about something, I think this business of accusing Joe Scarborough of murder is much more plausible. That is a much more serious, libelous sort of thing rather than just –
I think we're all looking at this backwards. I think that people dialed into Twitter. I don't think that Twitter is dying on this hill. I think enough people complained, and so now they're having to take action. I don't think this is sort of Twitter dreaming this up.
Yeah, but what's funny though is no one who's complaining to Twitter about this is leaving Twitter. So there's no, it seems like maybe to their board members or something like, guys, we got to fix it. We got to fix it. It's like a small number of really, really loud people complaining about it. And it's an own goal because just don't react. And I think the reason that there was reticence to do this and it wasn't done for 3 years is because it's a can of worms and you can't police all political speech on a social media platform. It's insane. It's a fool's errand. It's like a tower of Babel.
I think there are probably plenty of journalists who would say, don't shut him down, because at least we get to, after a year and some change of no press conferences, at least we get to monitor what's happening via Twitter. I mean, at least we can understand, what his thought processes are, like it or not, we're covering policy, we're covering his thought processes. We want to know what's going on.
Well, I think you and I have had a version of this argument or conversation before, Lisa. I don't think that his thought processes are all that relevant or helpful. I'm not a journalist. You are. I don't think America benefits one iota by following the 24/7 rants of this guy. It just upsets everybody. And boy, and they're not even accurate sometimes. So if we didn't, I would take him off the platform. For America, Twitter should do that. Hell, for the president's own sake.
I think if you, John, were running Twitter and you took him off the platform, you would inspire probably millions of people to leave the platform. And perhaps you would give an opening to someone to start a competing platform. I don't know how that would be in your.
Okay, but then Eric, are you damning at least Twitter for being complicit then in all of this?
No, I'm not. I'm not really not damning Twitter for this. I think that pretty much they have some very loose guidelines about inciting violence and pornography and a few other things that you can't do on the site. But those tend to be partisan neutral sorts of things. If you're going to run a site like that, that's how you have to do it. I don't see any other way. I mean, it would be nice to have a whole series of moderated discussions in which people are keeping. And I can tell you, when I used to run a blog at the Tribune, we had a comment section. I tried to do that and I was pretty successful at it, but it was a lot of work to make sure that people stayed on point. They didn't call each other names, that they made fair arguments. And again, it was a couple hours a day moderating these comment threads to make sure that they were useful. And I know Rich Miller at Capital Facts does that. He runs a very tight ship there, but it's work to do that. And that's just one blog and one comment thread and one topic at a time. You can't do it otherwise. So if we're gonna say this is a good thing to have, and on balance, I think Twitter is good. I like Twitter. I check it every day. I'm sure you guys do too, for all kinds of things. I was following, before we got on here today, I was following the Twitter feeds from Heather and other people out of Mayor Lightfoot's news conference. I think that's a really useful platform for that.
In New York Central Park, in an area known as the Ramble, a woman called the police after a black man asked her to leash her dog. It's a stark example of how people can use the police as leverage against black men in light of the Ahmaud Arbery and now George Floyd cases in Minneapolis. I'm amazed that these things are, if nothing else, so visible, guys. The police wear body cams. Everyone has a smartphone. Your excessive force or bad behavior will get caught. And the least of your problems may be that you'll lose your job. In Georgia, those vigilantes may go to jail. In New York, that woman lost her job. And in Minnesota, those cops were fired and may face criminal charges.
Well, I'll start with the Bramble case with Amy Cooper in Central Park.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop.
Please don't come close to me.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop recording me.
Please don't come close to me.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
And I'm taking pictures and calling the cops.
Please call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
It struck me that you could have had that entire altercation if she had not kept talking about him as an African-American man and saying, when she was calling the police, saying that she was being threatened by an African-American man. If she had just said, I'm being threatened, send the police, no one would have cared about that video. No one would have watched it because there's no way of knowing what's in her heart. She just opened up her heart and said and played that race card in a way that was just undeniable. I mean, it was just there's no way to explain what she said and how she described him as African-American other than pure racism.
I agree with you. It wouldn't have been the sensation it was without her making those racist comment. But having somebody tell you to leash your dog is not a reason to call 911. The racism is already there. I mean, she didn't have to say it, but she did. Yeah, she weaponized it somehow, and it's just sickening.
Were those the same day? I think they were. They were both on Monday?
There's daylight and there's dark time. That's how my days are ordered. Monday, Sunday, those don't count anymore.
But the point of the George Floyd, not the point, one takeaway from the George Floyd video is that by doing that, you truly put that man's life in danger by doing that.
Yeah.
And those were the stakes. The stakes weren't you just made a phone call. It was you have no idea how that interaction is going to go, how the police are going to react, or how he's going to react when it escalates, with the extreme case of being George Floyd.
It felt like the game of chicken to me, Austin, right? Like, are you really going to call the cops? Because when the cops come, I'm going to be in the right. And so he said, yeah, go ahead, call the cops. I'd love for them to be here.
When people are socialized to call law enforcement when they have a problem, that's going to harm black and brown people the most. And that's what was so clear about that video and the way that her voice made it seem as though she was in distress.
I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately.
That she was saying as an African-American man, that was sickening. Yeah, you were talking sort of about like the visibility of these cases and the reaction to the George Floyd video.
Man, I can't breathe in my face. Just get up. Ugh. I can't breathe. Please, the knee in my neck. I can't breathe shit.
I couldn't watch all of it, and I usually try to watch these things just so that I have the full effect and know what everybody's seeing, and I could not finish that one. It was so terrible and so blatantly wrong that you saw what I don't think you would have seen 5 years ago, which is police chiefs around the country saying, oh, this is murder. And you have Trump saying, you know, the FBI is going to investigate. Like, it was almost at 100% agreement that this is a travesty and that this person was murdered in broad daylight in front of other police officers and people.
The indifference is stunning, Eric.
Well, yes, and when you say in broad daylight, the other thing that really struck me was sort of how cold-blooded it was. And you see some of these other videos of some of these other confrontations that are caught, even the, you know, the Rodney King case where, you know, there's just adrenaline everywhere. Everyone is, and the, even the Laquan McDonald shooting, you know, the Jason Van Dyke is clearly like amped up and the situation is really tense. This is like the cop is just kneeling on the guy's neck while he's begging for breath. And his other cops are standing around nonchalantly, and it's horrifying for the coldness and the persistence of it. This was not a momentary rash act or a confrontation that got out of hand. This was a guy slowly squeezing the life out of somebody, and it is just horrifying.
There's a brief instance in that video where one of the police officers, responding to people saying, "Why don't you let him up now? He's not resisting," said,
"We tried that for 10 minutes.
That's a bum ass."
We wrestled with him for 10 minutes. The words 10 minutes can be heard, referring to the amount of time they tried to get him into the vehicle previous. So now it feels like they're punishing him for, you know, his resistance that we don't see. But boy, we don't see it. We don't, you know, I talked to a talk show host in Minneapolis today. And while you do see the two police officers, the one doing it and the one standing there, the other two cops who also got fired are in other videos seen on the other side of the vehicle. And they're just twiddling their thumbs.
There is some security cam video and some other video that precedes the one that we've all seen, right? And it may show more of the confrontation. But, you know, the thing about police officers is that, yeah, they get into these situations and sometimes they do have to subdue people and people are not nice to them. And I'm thinking of the case not too long ago, we saw the video of the drunk in Chicago, the guy, and the cop did a studio wrestling body slam the guy's head down into the curb. Remember this? Anybody?
Yeah. Sure.
And the cop was just angry because the guy had spit on him. And of course he was angry. I mean, that's extremely provocative. And citizens do that, and it's why we should value good police officers extremely highly and why they should be paid well and everything else. And it's a tough job, but he lost it. And one thing we don't want our cops to do is lose it. And if these guys had, even though they were calm, if they were using this chokehold, this fatal knee to the neck to punish him for having resisted, that's them not doing their job. They have to put the cuffs on him and put him flat on the ground, whatever.
There's a whole training system of de-escalation. Somebody called because he was apparently passed what turned out to be a counterfeit $20 bill. You know, I'm not sure having that kind of physical confrontation, I don't know how it started. You know, maybe he did resist, but is it worth it to sort of get into it with somebody over that, over a $20 bill, a counterfeit $20 bill? I'm just not sure.
Is it even clear that he knew it was counterfeit?
Did George Floyd know?
I have no idea. I'm just telling you what they were called out.
I mean, counterfeiting money these days requires some pretty expensive equipment.
And you or I may have a $20 bill in our wallets that's fake right
that's
now.
That's a good. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's not holding 10 people hostage in a store. You know, hey, what's going on here? And give them a chance to talk and have a discussion.
What if we mentioned like the hostage situation. In a hostage situation, or like I'm thinking of the Boston bomber, the police don't just come up to them and shoot them in the head. You have to arrest them and bring them to justice. That video, the reason that I think I couldn't watch the rest of that video, because it's as if he just put him on the ground and shot him in the back of the head, because that's what he was doing. And as Eric said, you know, the life came out of him. That was what was just so unbelievable about it. And I can't believe, like, even saying the words, like, police officers shouldn't kill people. It's crazy that we even have to say it. It's mind-boggling.
My guess is that the officer did not intend to execute the man there, that he was trying to subdue him, and he was pissed off about something we haven't seen. But he did. You know, the one of the videos that I'm reminded of is the one at the L stop in Chicago. Was it earlier this year in the fall?
It was earlier this year, yeah. Where the
police officer shot the guy about point blank, and there was two of them wrestling with the guy.
The guy who was walking from car to car. His offense was just moving from car to car, yeah.
Lisa made me think of it because I don't know where the training is or how hard it is for two or four officers to constrain somebody, but bullets or a knee to the neck probably should not be in their toolbox in that situation.
Today, I walked over to Jewel, and there was an argument in the parking lot. One guy had a knife. One guy had a bat. The guy with the knife was telling the younger guy, hey, you know, I got a gun in my car if you want to solve it like this. And everybody's like, oh, my God, you know, we're all at peak, you know, pandemic here. The police arrive, and there was no... They were talking to them like, okay, let's calm down. Everybody's stressed out about what's going on. And they were, and the officers had two, you know, like five officers with the one guy with the baseball bat, like seven with the guy with the knife who said he had a gun. And they were all just kind of hashing it out, right? There was no sort of, nobody's pinned to the ground. And these guys were, you know, essentially had weapons, you know, and there was none of that.
And what was the race of those guys?
I know the guy with the bat was white. I'm not sure about the man with the knife.
Steve Bertrand just joined us. He was monitoring the Lori Lightfoot press conference. She's announcing the Chicago rollout. Hey, Steve.
July 3rd, that's when we're all going to start hitting the restaurants and go outside. Not to the parks. The parks and libraries would be June 8th still. Did I say July 3rd? I meant June 3rd.
Oh, okay. And, start again. That's different.
And the lakefront is still closed indefinitely, right?
Right. She said that maybe later in phase three, and she was called on that saying, you mean late June? I'm sorry. I've got my... And she said, no, I didn't say that. I said later in phase three. So that's still going to be closed for the foreseeable future, I think. Another thing was she endorsed the idea of the NHL playoffs in Chicago. Which I thought was a nice idea too. She goes, I know how important the Blackhawks are to this city, and she'd like nothing more than to see the Blackhawks and the playoffs return to the United Center.
Any empty United Center, I presume?
I would think so. I think that was understood.
So, Steve, generally like the state then, but just a little bit later or no?
Just a few days. But, you know, I think when this first came up, she said, and they did go through a lot of health metrics and all of that, but I don't know if the issue for Chicago was as much the condition of the patients as it was just taking time to create new rules. I might be wrong about that, but they talked about how they're going to try to speed up the permit process for restaurants to be allowed to serve outside, things like that, looking at what streets they might close. But I do think she sort of left the door open for moving indoors a little more quickly. She said she has talked to the governor about that, with the idea of there are a lot of South Side and West Side restaurants that don't have the ability or the safety to open up outside.
Maybe they should forgive that $600 too.
Yeah. Did you see this, the Eater story, that they kind of dug into the language, and it says that if you have certain kinds of like these accordion windows, or if you have like a garage opening type of a front on your garage door opening on the front of your business, that would maybe be recategorized as an outdoor eatery, and you may be able to more quickly reopen.
That's great, because one of my favorite bars that I go to has a garage door.
All right, DM me because I want to know that place.
You have to drive to Lincolnshire, I'm afraid.
Oh.
Are there any red flags or attaboys that anybody wants to pass along? Anything about the governor's plan to reopen that seems especially wise or maybe a little reckless, Eric or Austin?
What aspect of this do you find reckless?
I think the most troublesome place is going to be at the restaurants and bars. And the virus is going to pop up and people will get infected. And
any indoor space is going to be problematic if you're there, especially there for a while. If you can have people gathering, whether it's a church or whether it's a bar or whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a sewing circle, if people are inside, numbers of them, that seems like that would ramp up your risk of infection. I don't know right now if there's a lot of evidence that being outside, even like those people were at Lake of the Ozarks, if that's going to be a huge problem. We're going to see in 7 to 14 days a bunch of people in Arkansas getting sick. So I don't know.
How soon before you're going inside for a restaurant, Austin?
Good question. If it has free flowing air, I would do it now. If it was in a different state, I would go. I think Steve's point is really good about the fact that part of this is due to the fact that the rules weren't written. And Illinois and Chicago have been so late on that. in Pritzker just this week is get like nail salons, places like that are like getting ready to open. And they only just got guidance from the state about what those rules look like. That's ridiculous. There's been other states that have had that for months.
And why are we forgetting that just last week, Dr. Birx said this is still a hot spot.
We still see these ongoing cases. And I've asked the CDC, and the CDC is working with the local areas in Chicago and this area in LA to really understand where are these new cases coming from. This is Chicago, again, just to show you going up into this high plateau that has been fairly persistent. Next slide. And this is Los Angeles. So you can get a flavor of where we have concerns, of where cities have remained closed and metros that have remained closed but have still persistent high number of cases.
Our numbers are still up there. I'm nervous about all of this. It'll be a while before I head out to a restaurant. We're trying to patronize these local places. It's going to be takeout for a bit.
I keep picturing the scene in The Wizard of Oz when the house has landed and we see the Wicked Witch's legs underneath the house.
The Munchkins call me because a new witch has just dropped a house on the Wicked Witch of the East. And there's the house, and here you are, and that's all that's left of the Wicked Witch of the East. And so what the Munchkins want to know is, are you a good witch or a bad witch?
But I've already told you, I'm not a witch at all. Witches are old and ugly. What was that?
The Munchkins.
And the Munchkins are deciding whether or not to come out, whether or not it's really safe. And I'll sing the song for you if you'd like now. Anyone?
How did you get to that? I get your point. So, how did you connect those dots?
So in a way, we've killed the virus, although I know we haven't killed the virus, but we've wounded the virus enough to where it might be safe to come out again. And don't you remember the Lollipop Kids and all the others who were just kind of slowly eking out of the bushes to see if it was okay? Like, that's not a reach. That's beauty. That's a beautiful.
Yeah, that's a lovely metaphor, Steve. I applaud your creativity there.
That's podcast art right there.
Right.
Well, I'm encouraged by the fact that it doesn't seem like Florida and Georgia have exploded in cases, even though they really relaxed their rules much as a month ago, I think it was, in Georgia.
For you guys, my former Tribune editor, who you know, Ross Werlin, who's living in Wisconsin now, said that Wisconsin this week had their biggest case number ever. I think it was just shy of 500 people.
Yeah.
So that's been 2 weeks since the Supreme Court ruling.
And Wisconsin just canceled its state fair. Illinois has yet to cancel its state fair, I think.
Yeah.
I think they did, didn't they?
No.
Sure they didn't?
No, we talked about that today. I mean, as of 2:17 on Thursday, the 28th, Illinois is a question mark on its state fair.
I'm looking it up.
Do.
Anyone want to buy my Lala tickets?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, you know, she talked about that too today, and she said, you know, people keep asking. Far more people ask, I think, than are actually interested. But she said, well, we're going to have an announcement coming up on that. And she tied that to an announcement about how music is going to return to the city of Chicago. Again, with the idea that there was some sort of plan out there or some sort of grander strategy that's going to come out that they've been working on. So that might be something we'll hear about next week.
Only the Bucket Boys.
Here we go. May 6th. Pritzker, highly unlikely, quote, that we will be able to hold our state fairs.
No, I wouldn't bet on it. I don't know why Lollapalooza's been dragging their heels on this. Just bite the bullet, guys. You're not going to be able to have Lollapalooza.
Isn't it interesting? I mean, there's another thing that's been going on in the news this week about movie theaters wanting to open up in Illinois. And some of them are saying that they want to open up at 25% or 50% capacity. And I don't see how these places make money. How does Hollywood make the money that it needs to make when you can only get, when you got a blockbuster movie, you can only get half the audience into the theater or less? How do restaurants make money if they are limited? I think the early limits are going to be to a 25% seating capacity, something like that. And health clubs. And how do these places actually make money if they're only able to serve half or a quarter of the number of customers they used to serve?
I don't know how health clubs will survive, many of them, because they'll be so limited. Not only will they be limited, people, I think, will be more reluctant to go back there than they would to a restaurant or to a movie theater. Movie theaters, and we've learned this, have another alternative, which is more lucrative than carryout for restaurants, and that's streaming. The number of movies that had been set for theatrical release were set directly to Netflix and elsewhere. And like the Smurfs, right, earlier. And I think they've done fairly well. I mean, so even though we might be reluctant to go to a movie theater, the product still is being seen. I suppose they're not being paid as much for that.
I wonder how it's going to shake out in the offices, too. I'm reading from the Tribune's description of what the governor's plan is for going back to our offices. Offices can reopen at 50% capacity. Mm-hmm. All employees who can continue working from home should be allowed to do so. That's gray language there. Employees should wear face coverings within 6 feet of coworkers, and employers should space out occupied workstations by at least 6 feet or install impermeable barriers between workstations. We don't have room for that where I work. So, and I haven't seen it yet. I'm in the office every day with not many people.
You and Elif are like 3 feet apart in your office, John. Is that still the case?
Would be, except Elif doesn't come into the office with me now. Okay. But our sales bay is where, you know, 25 people are congregated, and they're all cubicle to cubicle. And I don't know how they're going to resolve that.
Well, I was just going to say, too, you and I, and maybe not Austin, because he's still in his office, but we're kind of in a different mental place than a lot of people are, too.
Yeah.
Because we've already been coming into public spaces. You know, this isn't anything new for us, where it will be new for a lot of people. So there'll probably be a lot more anxiety that way than there is for you and I coming to work.
Well, the Tribune has the people shoulder to shoulder, aren't they, guys? I mean, it'll be hard for you guys.
Well, it used to be. Now, some people have left. But actually, my department, there are a lot of empty desks. I used to share space with Scott Stantis, who's now in Alabama, and Marie Dillon, who left the paper a while ago. And so we could space out pretty nicely, I think, mostly in Tribune newsroom. But I just don't know how many people are going to come back for a really long time.
Austin said that there is a story on his radar, which was, and I'm quoting him now, the most Illinois story we've seen in a very long time. And Austin, the stage is yours.
Thank you. Heather has a great story about this, actually. She wrote about it. And many people, and this seemed to be a story, there are those stories sometimes in like state policy that it seems like everybody in your family knows about, like your uncle's texting you about it, like what's going on. And this one was on lawmaker pay raises. So Illinois last week, in Illinois fashion, passed a budget in like 2 minutes. It spends more than any other budget before it. They upped spending 6% year over year during a pandemic when their revenue's way down. There's $260 million in automatic pay raises for state workers. It's a terrible budget, but one of the silliest things in the budget is the fact that they were not able to sufficiently stop their own pay hikes. And there's often a phrase this is like embodies Chicago corruption. It's that we don't want nobody that nobody sent.
Nobody sent, yeah.
The one that I like, and that says a lot about like Chicago and Illinois politics, but the one I really like is don't make no waves, don't back no losers. And that was a Daily Machine saying. And this is a classic case of the don't make no waves, which is the fact that what they essentially did was passed an illegal pay freeze that will be overturned in court if somebody sues, and they will get that $1,800 pay raise as state lawmakers. And the don't make no waves refers to the fact that if you do something good, make a good decision, the people who love you are going to forget about it in 2 weeks. If you make a bad decision, like hike your own pay in a pandemic, people are going to trudge through the snow and vote against you.
Isn't the wrinkle here, Austin, that according to state law, they can't give themselves a pay raise. So the pay raise is automatically built into the law, and they can only vote to reject the pay raise.
Exactly. So this back in 2013, 2014, Pat Quinn tried this sneaky move where he tried to cut or withhold lawmaker pay to get him to pass pension reform. And Madigan was obviously very mad at that because that gave someone power that wasn't him. And so they made pay raises what's called a continuing appropriation, which means that even if you put it down as $0 in the budget, you have lawmaker pay raises, a big fat zero next to it. It doesn't matter. It's an automatic spend. It's on autopilot. And so you have all these lawmakers responding to constituents saying, no, the budget I voted for has a zero in it. You have Susana Mendoza making a video saying, here's how much pay raise I'm going to give people this year, zero. Well, that's not her authority. She's the person who cuts the checks. The General Assembly's authority is to budget. And the law says their pay goes up. You have to pass a law specifically against it. And they didn't do that. So now there's all this debate around, well, are they going to actually get the pay raise or not? My suspicion is there will be a lawsuit, especially if a lawmaker retires soon, and they will get all that back pay and they'll get that raise.
Well, they've already had, this has already been litigated. Cook County judge ruled that lawmakers had violated the state constitution when they voted to freeze their pay from 2009 to 2016. I don't know if the judges acted on it, but the two lawmakers who filed suit was one, I guess they're two former state senators, Michael Noland of Elgin and James Claiborne, both Democrats. Claiborne's from Belleville. They asked the judge, okay, we want our pay. And the argument, I was reading a few references to that lawsuit. The argument is that they can't adjust it either way. They cannot freeze it. And they cannot hike it. So basically, whatever the stuff that was put in place during the Quinn administration, that also doesn't seem to track. That also doesn't seem to, you also can't hike it. I mean, it doesn't quite make sense, really. I think they are going to have a legal battle on their hands.
Austin, you've looked more closely at this budget story than maybe the rest of us. They raise spending. A lot of other states around us, I think Wisconsin cut spending. I think Indiana's cut some spending. Were there any arguments about this? Were there any debates? Like, were there any thoughts like, well, are there some employees, some parts of state government that really aren't doing much right now and that we could cut them without causing a lot of pain?
No. And the problem is that there's been no leadership on it from the governor's office. And if there's not that, then, you know, Harmon and Madigan aren't going to talk about it. So the contrast here, so back in early April, Pennsylvania's governor said, we're immediately furloughing 9,000 state workers because they can't complete their jobs through telework. Like, that was 2 months ago. Who are all the Illinois state employees who can't do their jobs through telework, and why are they still getting paid full salaries and getting pay raises? There's no shared sacrifice whatsoever. Gretchen Whitmer furloughed like 31,000 state employees. Gavin Newsom in California wants a 10% pay cut for state employees. Illinois is not only not doing pay raises, not doing furloughs, not doing layoffs, it's giving raises. It's giving $260 million of raises.
Why?
Effective July 1st.
I've been listening to all of this, but I mean,
are these union colas? Is that the deal?
It's part of a collective bargaining agreement. Yeah. And so.
No, it's not as easy. So it's not as easy to do what they've been in other states.
No, you've agreed to it 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
See, it's emergency. There's police powers. There's been no discussion of it.
Yeah,
and there's usually provisions in those sorts of agreements that talk about, you know, what you do in an emergency. And to be frank, I don't think J.B. Pritzker has been the biggest stickler on like his constitutional power, given that his argument is he can continue to issue 30-day emergency power declarations until infinity.
Have you guys brought up the Supreme Court today?
No, go ahead.
So the Supreme Court is requesting a briefing from Pritzker by tonight on one of the church appeals of his ruling. And they want to be open for Pentecost, which is Sunday. So is it Brett Kavanaugh, the justice for this district, signed off on their appeal yesterday and demanded that by 8 o'clock tonight, I'm not sure if that's seven or eight our time, that the Pritzkers have to offer an alternative view to the lawsuit, and that the justice may well rule against Pritzker's stay-at-home order anyway when it comes to churches by sometime before the weekend.
We had a pretty agitated caller on our show this week, and he was saying that it's a political power move by the governor to keep people out of churches. And we were trying to get from him what the advantage was. What power do you gain by keeping people out of church?
He just ended up by saying it was a power play in the end, but he didn't make an argument for how it works politically. And I don't think it does.
Yeah. Anytime you can exercise power, you do. But if it's to your detriment, there's no logic there. I don't understand that. He was arguing, too, that if we can go to grocery stores, we ought to be able to go to churches. You got to go to grocery stores to eat, and you don't sit there for an hour or an hour and a half, depending on how your church goes. It's just a different environment.
Well, the argument that I've heard a lot is, well, how can liquor stores be essential and pot dispensaries be essential, but church isn't essential? And I get that as a kind of a trick argument. But the fact is that John, you're exactly right. A church is a different setting. It's like, why is a church essential, but a playhouse isn't essential, or a theater isn't essential? I mean,
why is it a trick argument though? I mean, it is fun.
No, because you go into
liquor stores are essential, really. I mean, it is sort of a
safe. No, the word is safe. None of this is what's essential.
The argument for liquor stores is that you might create a black market for alcohol, and that there are people who are alcohol dependent, and you might cause more problems than you would solve if you closed liquor stores down. I'm not sure I buy that, but I don't think the analogy with the church is not right. It's not fair.
You're going to make bathtub gin, Eric?
But I will. Of course I will. But the question is, are you treating the church as an indoor space, as an indoor gathering space, any different than you're treating anything else? The Constitution demands that you do not treat the church differently, that you not disadvantage it in any way. And I certainly support that. If they say, well, yeah, the corner theater can open, but the church can't, or the Old Town School of Folk Music can open, but the church can't, that's wrong. But the fact that, I mean, the analogy with a liquor store or a grocery store, it just isn't apt. It doesn't make any sense. You go in and out of these places. And you walk through the aisles and you leave and you're acquiring things, but it's just not the same.
Somebody did this early on, and I don't know, maybe they got shut down for it, but they were telling people, look, you can call the rectory or whatever, call the parish office, and we're going to have 20 people and you'll be able to worship, and we're going to do this in the parking lot, so don't park in the parking lot. And there will be sort of designated areas where you can stand if you want to come. And people were doing it. And they were very far apart. But I don't know if that was shut down right away. But it seems to me that a lot of these places, they do have big parking lots. Just do something in the parking lot. Do it outside.
But I don't think that was allowed either under the order, at least not.
No, I know. I understand that.
Just back to you for a second, Austin. I'm reading from the Channel 7 website here and others. Illinois Comptroller Susanna Mendoza made known in a video statement that she released Wednesday that state legislators will not be getting raises in the next budget year, which begins July 1st. If what you said is true, then why did she say this? Why did she put a video out?
Well, because that's a very popular political stance to say, I'm not giving politicians raises. The problem is she doesn't have the authority to not give them. It's not her choice. The budget law is they go up. It's part of their compensation unless they say otherwise.
She didn't say, I don't like it or I don't want to do it. She said they're not going to get it.
Some state legislators seem to think they'll be getting a pay raise this year. The answer is no, they won't. Here's how much money the General Assembly appropriated for legislator raises or cost of living adjustments known as COLAs in this year's budget. Zero.
Well, good luck ensued.
But there's no way to follow that up. The next question is, right, because she put out a video, we can't do the follow-up question. The next question is, are we sort of, you know, mincing things here? You know, what does that mean? Yeah, bad, bad, bad. I'm sorry that I...
Hey, it's branding. It's okay.
We would have asked, okay, are you talking about a cost of living raise? You know, which is people sort of try to get around that. That's why they go cost of living bump or cost of living allotment. You know, it's a way to sort of get around calling it a raise. Because, well, no, you're making the same money. It's just it's a new year. And so you're making the same as you were last year.
I will predict right now that they will not get that raise because no incumbent lawmaker is going to sue, is going to go out on a limb and ask for his or her money in a time like this in court. But down the line, you're going to get a Claiborne or a Nolan once they leave office. They're going to go back and sue, and they're going to get the money anyway.
Right.
And then all the lawmakers go, well, if you're going to pay them, you got to pay me. So right. I'm guessing that as a temporary PR move, there's not going to be a single lawmaker who's going to demand his or her money right now. But down the line, we will end up.
Yeah.
And there's some pretty safe lawmakers. I wouldn't even take that. In 2016, a bunch of lawmakers sued to get their pay during the impasse when there was social service agencies getting shut down. Like, I do not underestimate the brazenness.
You may be right about that.
One last thing on that sort of front. What do you guys make of restaurants passing along COVID surcharges to their customers? Lettuce Entertain is doing it. And the, what was it, Steve? Popeye's near me?
No, Harold's.
Harold. On Broadway had it. Somebody Steve knows posted a picture of his receipt. So the next day I ran over there. It's near it. I walked over there and went and bought some chicken, and it was gone. And that was the next day. And the Tribune and Sun-Times have since followed up with stories saying that they took it down because their customers pushed back, but they did have that on there. It was 26%. I don't mind that because that still comes to about $1.50 or $2 on a chicken sandwich. Lettuce Entertain You is doing it at around, I think, 4%. And you can petition that and maybe they'll take it off. If my $10 chicken dinner cost me $11.50 or something like that, $12.
Just bump up the cost of the food if it's costing you more. Don't add it as a tax at the end. Just bump up the cost and people sort of suck it up. You know, there, this barbecue place that we love to go to, locally owned, with all the meatpacking plants closed, they're like, look, we're sorry. We know this is expensive, but we're trying to keep everybody on the payroll. So here's the deal with the brisket. That's going up. And fine. If that's the deal, fine. You know, I appreciated them telling me I can, it's verifiable. You know, if they're saying it, they don't want to lay anybody off, fine. But to do a COVID surcharge, come on.
Well, you want them to hide it? I mean, I don't like the language of that either, but what are they?
What's hiding it? A COVID surcharge that nobody knew about until they're sort of getting handed the bill. Have it on the front end. Say we're going to charge more for this food because we're trying to keep everybody on the payroll. That's not hiding anything. You're being upfront about it. A COVID surcharge is sort of that thing that's added in with the taxes and then you don't, what's this?
How's the brisket?
Oh my God. It's smoked barbecue, friends.
I just got smoked last week.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I'm walking distance from smoke. It's a great place.
Yeah. So love them. I don't want to call them out. I just appreciated them being upfront about it and they're good people. So
they had a very efficient pickup system also.
Yeah, they do. They do.
And the thing about it, I mean, I'm either way with Lisa about whether it should be included in the price of the food or if it's just an upfront charge that you see as soon as you walk into the place or as soon as you go online to order that they say, oh, we're going to add this. I think customers should not be hit with this at the end, like a service charge when you're buying from Ticketmaster or something. You know, mm-hmm. this ought to be something that you know about upfront. We've been tipping pretty generously, closer to 30% than 20% during this, because I feel like the people who are out there doing this, who are working in those kitchens and running food out to cars and stuff, they are taking their life into their hands in some ways, and they deserve a little extra combat pay. And also, maybe it helps keeps them going, keeps the restaurant going a little bit too. So
I mean, you don't like if you don't. A little bit of me at the beginning was like, well, I'm not going to go to any of these places. They're keeping people on the job, and I quickly sort of after talking to a few people who were like, okay, I've gotten laid off, I had to kind of rethink that. And yes, tip well.
Last thing I want to bounce off you guys is the who wore it worse, Joe Biden, who looked like a wasp. I don't mean a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. On Memorial Day weekend, he had on the black suit, the black tie, the black aviator glasses, and the black face mask, and that shock of white hair, and just a couple of features. He looked like an insect. And then you had the president who refuses to wear a face mask under any circumstances. Britt Hume over at Fox tweeted out a picture of Joe Biden and said, now you know why Trump doesn't want to wear one.
I feel like I've said this about masks every week in my column and on this program. It's like you wear a mask to show your respect for other people and your concern with their health, not just your own. And it is just the common, decent thing to do. And I think it does not speak well of Trump that he doesn't wear masks, and he should wear one. And his followers should realize that it's not unmanly or cowardly to wear a mask. And the sooner more of us wear masks, the sooner we'll be able to open up the lakefront and be able to dine inside.
I still want Dr. Birx to call him out. She had another opportunity since we met last. Somebody asked her about his not wearing one, and she said he's able to socially distance. And I just don't know why it's so hard to call him out on that stuff.
There was a great piece in the New York Times about how, you know, working in the National Institutes of Health and the CDC, how that's always been a political job. And the author had, I forget what arm of the National Institutes of Health she worked for, but it was kind of a fascinating take that it's hard to separate it. And there are lots of people who opine because I feel like Dr. Birx gets called out more than Dr. Fauci. We can talk about the sexism there maybe another time, but they feel the need in reading several stories about both of them. They feel the need to sort of stick around, that they know what's going on, that they want to get the message out to the people, and they're not going to fight with somebody who can't be fought with, basically. They're not going to win.
How many times have we heard that scenario? I mean, I agree with you. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing that I want them around, but how many times have we heard people on the inside say, well, we're sticking around here just so we can help and make it better? All of them.
Yeah. And I don't think it's just specific to the, I know so, folks here don't want to hear this, but I don't think it's specific to this administration. Yeah. Okay.
All right, kids. Well done. Thank you for your time and effort, Eric and Lisa. You guys hang in there to our furloughed Tribune friends, or to be furloughed Tribune friends. We're rooting for you guys.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.